All right, we're ready for seminar number 8, Discipleship, How to Develop Laborers. Find it on page 21 in your manual. Jesus said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." I suppose that's true in every generation, in every age, probably in every cultural setting. There's never enough laborers. There's always more work to do than there are people available to do the work. So Jesus has instructed us to pray for laborers. Interesting thing about that section is the context in which Jesus made that appeal to his disciples. Jesus was busy doing ministry at the time. And I love verse 36. Seeing the multitude, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and downcast like sheep without a shepherd. There's a lot I think we can take away from that, a lot of things we can learn from observing Jesus. And the disciples obviously were observing those things as well and noticing things about Christ. But we're going to talk in this section about how do we equip people to do ministry. How do we equip, we made the comment yesterday that the ministry belongs to the people of God. That it's not the exclusive domain of pastors and elders. That the more we can equip the people of God to be involved in the ministry, the more the body of Christ is going to reach maturity, the more it's going to be built up. So if we want to equip people to become laborers, what are some of those critical areas that we want to see? What is the need? And in verse 36, there are three things that we can pray for. There are three things we can strive for. One is, we want people with an ability to see. Or to say it another way, we want people to be able to see the way Jesus sees. That's how that verse starts. He was seeing the multitude. He looked at the multitude. And of course, we know that when God looks at men, he looks not at the outward appearance, but at the heart, right? And so we know that idea very well. That's a difficult thing for us to do, because what we have a tendency to simply do is look at what's on the outside. We'll never see people exactly how Jesus sees people. That's clear, because he's the Lord and he knows what's in the hearts of men. John tells us in his gospel in a way that we don't know what's in the heart of men. But that doesn't mean that we can't move down that road, that God can't begin to give us the ability to see inside the heart of people and to begin to understand something about what they're feeling and what they're thinking and what they're experiencing, what they believe and what they don't believe, what their presuppositions are, those kind of things. But it takes work to do that. And so we need to ask God, and I think it's a good thing for us to pray, "Lord, help me to see people the way you see people. You know, would you just open my eyes and help me to not be so predisposed to make quick judgments about a person based on, you know, how they're dressed or where they came from or anything else that might make me come to conclusions." It's so easy for us to do that. So I think one of the things that we need is we need to ask God for that kind of an ability. One of the things that I do when I'm training guys in the area of evangelism and ministry in general is I take them through a little study of the kinds of questions that Jesus asked. Now, Jesus could just look at a person and know what was in their heart. I understand that. But have you ever studied the questions that Jesus asks? Go to the book of Mark sometime, and just, if you have a Bible you mark in, just highlight questions that Jesus would ask in the course of his ministry. And then go back and analyze the kinds of questions that he asked. And one of the things you'll find is that Jesus had a lot of different reasons for asking questions. He had different purposes for asking questions. And we do that as well. You know, we talk about a rhetorical question. You know, it's a question that we ask to teach a particular truth. But you can ask, you know, questions to simply discern things about a person. You want to know what's in their heart. You know, so evangelistically, we come up with questions like, if you would die tonight, do you know for sure you would go to heaven? Well, we don't ask that just out of curiosity. We ask that because we want to know what this person, what's in their heart. We want to be able to see them a little bit more clearly. And, you know, you can ask the same question with different intents and with different purposes. Something as simple as, how are you? You know, you can ask that question as a greeting. How you doing? Right on by. Or you can look a person in the eye and say, how are you doing? You know, and you really want to know, and they know you want to know. You're not asking it as a greeting. You're asking it because you really, you care about them. So, it's a fun study to do, but it's a productive study to do to begin to see that sometimes when Jesus would ask a question, he would ask it because he was rebuking the disciples. Why do you have such little faith? It was a challenge, you know, to them. Sometimes he would ask questions that would lead them to application. Sometimes he would ask questions because he wanted them to know certain things or to think about things that they'd not thought about. And we can use questions for a whole bunch of different reasons. But all of that with an intent to help us to see people, to see what's in their heart. We need to become masters in studying people and knowing what people are like. We'll never do it infallibly. We'll make some mistakes. But this is what we want in us. And when we're going to train people to be laborers, we want them to gain the same kind of thing. We want them to be able to see the needs. You're not ever going to meet the needs of people if you don't see the needs. Right? That's just obvious. You've got to learn to see needs. You've got to be perceptive. Once you begin to see needs in the people around you, ministry just opens up all over the place. Right? So this is a good starting point, is an ability to see. Second thing that we see in this verse 36 is a desire to love. And it's something that we need. We need a desire to love. When Jesus saw the multitude, then what? He felt compassion. Right? And this is that Greek word splagna, you know, kind of sounds like what it means. It's a word that means guts. Bowels. It's the same word, you know, when Judas was ripped open in the middle, his splagna fell out. You know, it was his bowels fell out. And so the word gets used to mean affections. Paul used it in Philippians that way. The word, it was translated affection. Because this word means the seat of our emotions. It means our deepest inner being. So when Jesus looked at people, what happened? Something stirred deep inside of him. He was moved with compassion, is how some of the translations actually translate that. So there's something that happened. I mean, sometimes we look at people, we see people, what happens? We get cynical, or we get hard-hearted, or we get skeptical, or we get critical. You know, we're not moved with compassion. Just the opposite happens. So what we really want in us, ought to want in us, and what we want to develop in people we're trying to train to be laborers, is we want them to have a desire to love people. So this is critical. You can see needs, but if you don't love, if love doesn't follow what you're seeing, ministry will not happen. You know, it's a love for people that motivates us to do ministry. Why else would we do ministry? You know, that I suppose for sordid gain is what Peter would say. That's an option. You know, there's something, be selfish, be something we think we could get out. But if we're going to strip that away, why else would we do ministry if it were not for love? So that we need that. And again, as we pray, and this is just a great verse to be praying for yourself. God, give me an ability to see people the way you see. And then God, would you stir my heart? Would you move me with compassion? God, protect me from hard-heartedness. And then thirdly, Jesus had a willingness to act. He had a willingness to act. And you see it in the earlier verses. I don't have them printed here. But what was Jesus doing as he saw people, as he was moved to compassion? He was healing them. He was setting them free from sin and from demons and from all kinds of sicknesses. This is what, when Jesus felt something stir inside, he always acted. In fact, if you do a little word study on this splagnet, what you'll find is, there may be one exception. I'm not sure there's any exceptions. I think the word is always used in connection with action. And the connection is so strong in the scriptures that I think it's safe to say that if there's not action of some kind, then there's probably no real compassion. That this kind of biblical compassion, that's just where it takes you. That's just what it leads to. If you're truly stirred up, you're going to do something. And if you don't do something, you may convince yourself that you have compassion, but not in the way that Jesus demonstrated, not in the way that the New Testament talks about compassion. So there's a willingness to act. So this forms, I think, kind of our theology of laboring, if you will. You know, these are the central components to anybody that's going to be a laborer. They can see needs, they're moved and stirred by the needs, and they're willing to do something about it. Right? So if those things are built in, then it simply becomes a question of training people. You know, how do we teach them what to do? You know, that's what we want to do when we're training laborers. We want to give them what they need to be able to do what they ought to do. All right? Now, why are there so few laborers? You know, why did Jesus go on to say the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few? Now, 2 Timothy 2, I think, gives some answers to that question. This is, of course, Paul exhorting Timothy as he's leaving his final instructions to him, but I'm not going to read all 19 verses to you there, but this is the place where he's addressing some of the things that have to be present in the life of a laborer. Why are there so few laborers? Well, number one, it's costly. Suffer hardship with me as a good soldier of Christ. No soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. It's costly to be a soldier. You're not like everybody else. There are all kinds of things that you have to give up. I have five kids, and my fourthborn, Stephen, joined the Marine Corps last year. So he's come through boot camp, and now he's in his MOS, his Military Occupational Specialty School, where he's learning to drive amphibious assault vehicles. And he's having a ball, you know. He said, you know, who gets to do this kind of stuff? You know, it's like playing war in the backyard with real man toys, you know. But there's a price to pay to be a Marine. You know, his time is not his own time. He can't go where he wants to go like he used to do. He can't do what he wants to do like he used to be able to do. He's paid a significant price to enlist in the Marines. And he's, you know, every weekend their training's done, but they don't get to go anywhere. We stay here. You know why? Primarily because they don't want them entangled in the affairs of everyday life. And that's exactly what they tell them. We're not going to let you go out there because we know what Marines do when they go out there. So, you know, it's costly. And this is what Paul is telling Timothy. Be a laborer is going to cost you something. You're going to be a soldier. Not only is it costly, it requires selflessness. Not only does he use the analogy of a soldier, but also an athlete. If anyone competes as an athlete, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. So, you know, an athlete has to play by the rules of the game. He has to be willing to submit himself to those things. And he has to give up certain things. You know, athletes that are in training, they don't do everything that everybody else does. You know, their diet's more restricted, and they're out there working in a disciplined fashion to train themselves for the games. There's a selflessness that comes with athletes that are really good. They're really committed. They die to themselves, so to speak. And Paul's saying that's what a laborer has to do. He has to be like an athlete in training who submits himself to the rules, not only of the game, but of the training to be able to compete in the games. Thirdly, it's hard work. There are few laborers because it's just hard work to accomplish. He uses the farmer as his third analogy, and farmers work hard. There's not a lot of you don't become a farmer because you like the accolades of men, right? When you're plowing the fields and when you're harvesting, there are not people lined up and down the aisles of the field saying, "Man, way to go, you know, plow that thing straight, you know, that's fantastic, way to go, keep going." There's nobody there, you're by yourself, right? Just working hard, getting up early, working late into the night, pouring out yourself. It's hard, hard work. Being a laborer is not easy, and you, all of you here know that. It is just plain hard work. There are few laborers because it's also burdensome. Suffer hardship with me, he says. Endure all things. You know, there are great burdens that come with the ministry. You know, there's that section in Corinthians where Paul's talking about all the things that he's done, you know, all the price that he's paid. But he says, you know, above all that, there's that daily weight upon my soul of the burdens of the church. And nobody feels that quite the same way that a pastor or a church planter feels it. There, you know, elders that come alongside you feel that, people in the congregation can feel to some degree, but nobody feels it quite the same way that a pastor feels those burdens. You live and die with every bump in the road. You know, with every good thing, you soar with excitement. With every disappointment, you know, it can be just so difficult and such a burden. So not many people are willing to bear that. It's not easy to be a pastor. It's not, and it's harder to be a church planter. Right? So it's burdensome work. Next, it's a spiritual work. You know, he talks here about the gospel. So he gets into verses 8, 9, 10, 11. You know, it's the gospel here. You know, what is the workplace? Where's the workplace for a pastor or church planter? It's not a factory. It's not an office building. It's the souls of men. That's the workplace. Right? It's that unreachable spot deep inside a man or a woman or a family that only the Spirit of God can reach. That takes an understanding of the gospel. It takes maturity. It takes commitment to Christ. It takes intense trust that Jesus somehow will use us as weak, broken vessels to reach other people because of His goodness, because of who He is, not because of who we are. So it's a spiritual work. And not many people, you know, are willing to do that kind of spiritual work. It's easier to do other kinds of work. And then finally, it requires training. Verse 15, you know, you need to be a workman. You need to be approved by God. You need to accurately handle the Word of God. So there, you know, it takes training, you know, and that's true, of course, in other areas as well, but no less so for a laborer. So why are there so few laborers? Well, there's a few ideas. You can expand the list. I'm sure you could double it pretty quickly, but just out of this one passage, we can see pretty readily why there aren't many people that are willing to be laborers. Why our churches are filled with godly, mature men and women who are walking, you know, the mature disciples, but not laboring. You know, you can get disappointed so easily. You begin to invest in somebody, you're excited about what's going to happen, and then they get involved in sin, they bail out. It's just discouraging. I've had, you know, people in the congregation in Lafayette who've done some discipling of other people, and then the person, they fall out of the Christian life. We have a jail ministry. You know, don't do jail ministry if you're not ready to be disappointed. You know, if you're not ready to suffer. Because, you know, there's so many gripping sins that are hard to overcome. And I've had some of the ladies in our church that have worked with some of the ladies that have come to, made professions of faith in jail, and then they get out and they just kind of punt the Christian life, you know, and they say, I don't think I can keep doing this. This is killing me. Because it's so disappointing. You invest, you know, you give your heart away. And then there are times it just doesn't go the way you wish it would. So people don't want to do it. Now, of course, there's the other side too, and that's the victory of the gospel and changed lives. That's why we do it. All right. So let's go on. Those are some reasons why there's so few laborers. Well, what kind of laborers do we want to develop? It says defining a laborer. I'm not going to give you a definition. Let me give you a few bullet points. All right. Here are just some characteristics. You can kind of jot these down. If a person's a laborer, these are things that ought to be present in their life. They need to, number one, love God more than they love themselves. You know, that's the Christian life, right? But how much more for a laborer? You know, they've got to be so deeply committed to Christ. You're not going to labor, you know, if you're selfish, if you're, you know, all about what I want to do and bought into the entertainment of the world and simply pursuing pleasures and those kinds of things. There's a lot of Christians that are caught up in that, not necessarily blatantly sinful things, but just kind of a self-centered life. You know, so a laborer is going to love God more than himself. Secondly, he's going to love people as himself. You know, this is basically the two greatest commandments. A person, if they don't, we already said this up in Matthew 9:36, if a person doesn't love people, he's not going to labor. Thirdly, a laborer has to be a mature disciple. So the order is important on the circle diagram, right? You don't train somebody to be a laborer and then hope, you know, that through that maybe they'll start to grow. You know, even Paul said, don't lay hands on a man quickly, you know, because there's all kinds of problems that are going to come with that. A laborer has to be well established in their walk with God. And one of the reasons for that is we're talking about spiritual reproduction here. So what are you going to do when you labor? If you give yourself to somebody and help them grow in the faith, you're going to reproduce yourself. The things that are in you, you're going to reproduce that in the person that you give yourself to. They're going to probably pick up your strengths and your weaknesses. So you want laborers to be mature in their own faith. Fourth, they have a desire to help others. This is something that they want. So it's not just that they love people, but they really are willing. You know, they've come to the point where I want to see God use my life. You know, I love it when you can begin to hear somebody talk like that. I want to see God use me in somebody else's life. Hope you have your ear out for that kind of a heartbeat in people. You know, who is out there showing that they really want to make themselves available to God? And then just two more kind of skill things. A laborer has to have skill in evangelism. Right? They have to have some abilities to be able to talk to others about the gospel. And they have to have skill in building others up or skill in establishing people. So, you know, we can define a laborer in a lot of different ways. And I think that's, you know, I'm using, admittedly, a fairly narrow definition of a laborer. You know, because sometimes what we do is we confuse just some of this working and doing a task with how I've been trying to talk about what a laborer is. You know, if you have somebody can be on a building committee, for instance, no doubt that they're working. No doubt that they're giving themselves to the church, that they love the church, and that we need people to serve on the building committee. But somebody serving on the building committee is not a laborer in the sense that I've been talking about a laborer. So you see how there can be some confusion here. They're working, they're giving themselves, and so in the broadest sense, yeah, they're a laborer. But I'm trying to talk about a laborer as somebody that knows how to minister to the souls of people, right? So that's where we're looking at somebody that's got some basic skills in sharing the gospel, doing evangelism, and helping people grow, helping people walk with God, helping people in their union with Christ. So I would suggest, if you boil all down, there are three things that are essential for a person to be a laborer. Number one is they have to have desire. In other words, they have to have the want to. Secondly, they have to have vision. Thirdly, they have to have skill. Quite a few years ago, Jenny and I, my wife, decided that we wanted a deck on the back of our house. We thought, you know, that would be cool. We just had this growing desire for a deck, right? So we started talking about, well, why do we want a deck? Well, we could have cookouts there, you know, we could have people over, we could sit out there, we could have fellowship. So that this desire for a deck began to grow within us, just as, you know, you can have desires for a lot of things. So we had the desire for a deck, and as we talked about, we thought, well, you know, maybe I could build the deck. Now, I'm not a great carpenter, but I think maybe I got enough skill I could do that. I wasn't really sure. So number two, decided that we needed to cultivate the vision, you know. So what's this deck going to look like? How big is it going to be? What shape is it going to be? What kind of materials do you need for a deck? I had to learn about floor joists and posts and how deep you have to set things to get below the frost lines. So I started doing all this research on building decks. And the more I was doing that, just my vision was expanding. I had a desire. We wanted the deck. Now I'm building the vision for it. So we got the plans all drawn up and all the calculations done and all the wood ordered and the lumber company delivered it. It was a big pile of, man, it's just cool. You know, smells good, looks good. Man, I could see the deck, you know, with this pile of wood because I had vision. I knew what this was going to look like in the end. At least I hoped. So then came the day to start building the deck. And this is where the rubber meets the road, right? So first thing is I have to dig the post holes to put these posts in. And according to Indiana Code, they had to go, I forget now, it's 24 or 28 inches deep to get below the frost line. I need a post hole digger. So I talked to my next door neighbor. Post hole digger? He said, yeah, you know, so, you know, one of these things, you know. So have you ever been to Indiana and tried to dig in the, it's like, it's clay, you know, so 20 minutes later, I mean, I'm just, sweat is pouring off of me. I'm pounding this thing in the ground, and I'm down about 2.5 inches. And I'm supposed to, I think I had 9 of these things I was supposed to dig. This is not going to work. So I get in my car, I drive down the street to the rental shop, and I said, you have an auger, you know, that I could use to dig a post? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Give him the money, take this auger home. I've never even seen one of these things, let alone used it. Yeah, so I get out there and I get the thing started up and I'm trying to mess around. I get it right there on the spot, you know, and there's a little rev up thing here. And so I hit the gas. And I begin to twist my arms around like that about pulling my shoulders out of their sockets. And my next door neighbor's in the backyard just laughing at me, just laughing at me. Thinks it's the funniest thing he's ever seen. So I said, you know how to use one of these things? I said, yeah, of course I do. So would you mind showing me? So he walks over and takes him about 3 minutes to train me how to use this one-man auger. And he shows me, give me a couple of tricks and says, here's how you keep from killing yourself. And guess what? 20 minutes later, half hour later, I got 9 28-inch post holes dug. It's fantastic. But what I needed was skill, right? What's that? The deck is still standing. Yes, you can come and enjoy a cookout with me on our deck. Got the whole thing built. All three of those things were absolutely critical. You have to have desire. You have to have vision. As we were talking about last night, what do you want to accomplish in this church plan? How's God want to use your life? Because one thing, a lot of guys come to seminary. They have a desire. I want to be a pastor. God wants me to be a pastor. Got this desire. Well, what is a pastor? Well, that's something that preaches. Okay, that it? Hey, vision, you know, got to develop vision. You know, people in the congregation, same way. You think God could use your life? Yeah, I want God to use my life. Well, what does He want to do with your life? Well, I don't know. They need vision, so you build vision. How are you going to do it? Okay, now you got vision. How are you going to do it? Let me teach you. Let me give you some basic training. Let me build some skills into your life. You take away any one of those three, You will not have a laborer. And you can find people that have two of the three, you know. They have a desire, but they don't have any vision, so they don't know what they're doing, you know. They may be skilled in certain areas and certain things, but no vision, they can't pull it all together. So they're just all over the road map. A little bit here, a little bit there, never finishing anything, never driving toward any godly, kingdom-oriented purpose. Got people with desire and vision, but they don't know what to do. They just need some help. You got other people that they've got some vision. They've gotten some training someplace. They're gifted. They're skilled. They could really help. But guess what? They don't have any desire. They're too busy. You know, every congregation, you know, got somebody in the congregation. They're just gifted. They're talented. You know, they've got everything they could give so much to the church. But all they can think about is their next vacation. That's why they just live for vacation. I've known two guys in the course of my ministry like that. They're just neat guys. I mean, they love Christ. They're in the Word every day. You know, they're walking with God. But all they can think about is their next vacation. It drives me insane. They're always making their plans for their next trip, you know. So they've got vision and skill, but they don't have any desire. So they don't labor. So the point is, these three things, they're all really, really important. And if we're going to train laborers, we have to take responsibility to build these things, you know, at least to try to build them, to, you know, to help them to see the value of investing their life in somebody else. That's what creates desire. When they say, you know, God could really change your life, could change somebody's life through you. And they begin, oh, really? You know, God could use me. And they begin to get a desire, and it kind of comes hand in hand with the vision. Those two things work in connection with one another. So we have to work on this. I want you to look at this next section, defining a task, because that may be just something that's really important. Because I think, again, we have certain tendencies in the RP church, and maybe they're not true in the broader church. I don't know that for sure, but I do think. My observation in the RP church is we have a tendency to train people. We think of training in terms of position instead of mission. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a fundamental mistake. And when I say that, I don't mean that we don't ever train for position. Sometimes we do, you know, we may have an elder training class. I've done elder training classes. I don't have any problem with elder training class, but what we really need to do first and foremost is we need to be training people with a mission orientation toward the kingdom, not a position orientation. Almost anybody can learn to do a task, right? Just like I could learn to do an auger. We can teach certain tasks. We can fulfill certain positions. I use Bible study leader in one sense, and that may be a little bit confusing, but, you know, I can teach somebody how to lead a Bible study discussion. I can teach them basic skills. Here's how you ask a good question. Here's how you lead a discussion. You know, that's on one level, it's kind of just a skill that can be taught. But what you can do is you can have somebody who knows how to lead a good small group discussion, but if they don't first have a vision for mission, what are we trying to do in this Bible study? Where are we trying to go with this thing? What's the vision behind this? What are we trying to accomplish? Then you have somebody that leads good discussions, but doesn't drive toward holiness, doesn't drive the group toward Christ-likeness, doesn't drive the group toward whatever the purpose of the small group is. Isn't able, for instance, to see within a small group of people. You may have one person in that small group that's a brand new believer, really needs some personal attention. The stuff we were talking about in the last hour. Somebody that's been trained with mission orientation will say, there's somebody that needs a little bit of help. And they give it to them. So the small group actually becomes a pool for deeper ministry. Or maybe there's somebody that's really gifted in that group. Say, boy, that person, you know, so that person has desire for ministry. That person really, they've got some vision. They've got some thing. I'm going to give them a little extra training. So your small group becomes a pool to find people to train. Laborers, you know, that you can pull out. You're not going to be able to do it. Small group leader won't do that if they have not been trained for mission, if they've only been trained for a position. Now, we need people who carry out all these functions. You know, there are a lot of positions that do need to be filled. So we need, you know, people who serve on the CE committee and people who be on the building committee and those kind of things. So, you know, there's an important place for that. Some of these positions don't require a person to be a laborer in the small, in the way I've been defining it. You know, again, you can have somebody on the building committee and they don't have to be a laborer. But there are some positions that it's just imperative that the person be a laborer. You know, somebody actually alluded to this, I think, earlier in our seminar. You wouldn't want an elder, ideally, right? That's not a laborer. You wouldn't want an elder that doesn't know how to handle the Word of God, that can't share the gospel with somebody, that can't help somebody in the church go deeper into Christ. We're not looking for administrators. We're not looking for people to sit on a board to simply make policy decisions for the church. We want laborers. See, you never have an elder that can't labor in some of these basic kinds of ways. Yeah, I fear that sometimes that happens. But they have certain personalities and certain things that the world views as leadership skills. But, you know, that's not what we see in terms of what Christ lays out. Well, anytime a person is a true laborer and they've really been trained for mission, they'll bring a whole new dimension to the church and to whatever task you give them to do. They won't be confined to a position. Laborers will labor, whether they hold office or not, whether they have official, you know, task in the church that's been given. Laborers just labor. You know, if you get a big congregation, well, all you do is kind of look out in a general sense and say, where's ministry popping up? You know, where do I just kind of see ministry happening in the church? And then I look and say, well, who's in the middle of that? There's your laborer, right? Wherever ministry's popping up, there's going to be a laborer there somewhere. Those are the kind of people that you're looking for. Those are the people that understand mission and not just task. So we really want to drive, I believe, toward first training for mission, giving vision and creating desire and giving skills. And then we can think, okay, now, you know, what positions do we need these laborers in? And then those are the people that we want to ask God to raise up. And if you don't have a position, you know, your laborer, you'll just keep laboring anyway. Right? Does that make sense? Any questions about that? Okay. 1 Thessalonians 2 is another passage that I think is significant in the kind of ministry we've been talking about here this weekend. This is Paul reflecting back on the time that he had in Thessalonica. It wasn't a long time, but it was a very significant time. And I really like verse 8. For me, it kind of captures the heartbeat of when we talk about discipleship or disciple-making, whatever term you want to use for it. Paul says, having thus a fond affection for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become very dear to us. This is really the heart of discipleship. We're not just given facts. Paul said, we're giving you that. We're giving you the gospel. We're giving you all the truth, but we gave you our life. You know, and there's so much that we can invest when we give our life to another person that they can gain by seeing things in us and they learn. And Paul wasn't shy about saying that to Timothy. The things you saw in me, the things you heard in me, the things you observed in me. It's life on life. And Timothy, you learned a bunch of stuff from me just by being with me. Jesus appointed the 12 that they would be with him, so that they could see how he lived and see how he ministered to people. In the training of laborers, this is a key element. We need to impart our life. I think it's important in establishing as well as in training. Both sides of that bottom part of the circle diagram, these truths can really be helpful. Again, we use a lot of different terms. Everybody's got definitions. So I like to define terms, and you know, a couple of the really popular terms now are mentoring and discipling. Is there a difference? It all depends on who you talk to. Sometimes they're just synonyms, and they get used interchangeably. I make a little bit of a distinction in my own mind. Mentoring, as I have it here for you, is inviting another person into your life and family so that they can see your faith and life in Christ lived out before them, teaching them how to live for Christ in the context of life. Not everybody has really developed all of the skills to be able to systematically sit down with, a brand new believer and help them. You know, remember that list of 8 things I gave you, you know, that you could follow somebody. So, well, I don't think I could sit down and kind of do a Bible study with them in each of those 8 areas and really help them. But I have a quiet time. I could tell them what I do. I could maybe have a quiet time with them sometime. I could talk to them about how I pray. You know, I'd be happy to have them around. To me, that's more what mentoring is. It's just life on life in the context of life. We had a gal that came to Christ a couple of years ago, and she had been influenced by one of the ladies in our church, and she didn't feel comfortable. She said, "I don't think I can really follow her up or disciple her the way, you know, we'd talked about it in the church." But she said, "I love her. I'm happy to have her around." I said, "Why don't you just invite her over to your home once a week? Just have her there for the afternoon. Let her hang out with you while you're cooking, while you're doing whatever you're doing around the house, when the kids are coming home from school, whatever. And just talk to her about your relationship with Christ. And just talk to her about her life, answer her questions." I said, "You know, you would be a great mentor for her." And that's exactly what she did. She just started having her over, and they enjoyed some of it. She ended up doing more than once a week. They were just together a lot. She just poured her life into this guy. I said, along the way, help her learn how to have a quiet, and just a few things you can help her learn. She said, "I can do that." And she did it. And God really blessed that. Discipling, I think of as being a little bit more systematic, maybe a little bit more organized. And I think one of the things we can do when we're really wanting to train a laborer is that there are some things we could do to say, okay, let's start. If we're going to go through the door of union with Christ, let's take whatever topics we want to take under that. And I've got that list of 8 that I use. How can you systematically learn how to disciple a young, brand new believer in these 8 areas? And I learned back when I was in college something that I was involved in the Navigators before I got involved in the church, and they talked about follow-up plans and how to systematically follow up a new believer. And I think I've got in here in one of the appendixes developing follow-up plans. It's appendix number 8 on page 12. And what I do when I want to train a guy to learn how to establish a new believer is I'll take him through developing follow-up, what we call follow-up plans. So we're going to take these 8 areas of the Christian life. We're going to do a little Bible study. I mean, not we. You're going to do, I say to him, you're going to do a little Bible study on this. We're taking one at a time, and then I'm going to help you develop a plan for following up a new Christian in that particular discipline of the Christian life. And so I've developed some little Bible studies on each of these 8 topics. I have them do the study. We discuss it. And what we're trying to do is build the foundation for helping this new Christian have conviction in this area. What does the Bible really teach about this? You know, and so he learns that. And then I take him through this follow-up plan, this Appendix 8 you see here, and he develops a 5-point plan for each of the area, writes out an objective. Here's what I want to see happen in this area of, say, quiet time. This is the convictions I want this new believer to develop. This is the practice that I want them to develop. Remember those 2 things, practice and conviction. So that's my objective. Here's some of the tools that I'm going to use to accomplish that. I'm going to use these scripts. These are the key passages of Scripture that I want them to see. Here's maybe a key book on that topic. Here's a couple of illustrations that will help make this come alive for him. So these are my tools. And then strategy, how am I going to implement this? How am I going to take the tools and apply them to this new young Christian So I'm gonna do certain things. I'm gonna take them through a little study on this topic, and here are the verses I'm gonna use. If it's quiet time, my strategy might be I'm gonna have a quiet time with him, so I can actually show him how to have a devotional life. So he can just step by step. I can show him how to do that. There's nothing like learning by doing and seeing. So you develop a strategy. Here's how I'm gonna help this guy grow in this area. Other resources is just an area for maybe other things that you've heard, maybe a good message that you've heard preached on that you kind of have made a note of, or some other books or other illustrations or other things that you might want to put in there. It just gives you a place to list resources. And then the last part of the follow-up plan is the evaluation. How are you going to know if this guy really has been discipled and established in this area? What are some questions you can ask yourself? You know, like quiet time. Well, is he having a quiet time? Is he spending time with the Word, in the Word, with God every day? Does he enjoy it? You know, do I ever hear him share insights that he gets from his time alone with God? And so you come up with 3, 4, 5 questions that you can ask yourself to help evaluate that. So what I do when I'm trying to help train a guy to establish new believers, I take him through these 8 things so that when he's done, he's got 8 Bible studies that he's done in each of those areas. He's got 8 follow-up plans. And then what I can do is that somebody comes to faith in Christ, I can go to that guy that I've trained and I say, okay, now here's your opportunity. Would you meet with this guy over the course of the next 2, 3, 4 months, whatever it takes, and would you help him become established in his faith? Would you teach him how to spend time with God? Would you teach him how to pray? Take him through this. Help him develop convictions. Help them develop practice. And then he goes out, and often you have to kind of walk them through it that first time, you know, because it's one thing to have the theory, it's another thing to actually do it. But once a guy's done that, well, I tell you, it gets in his blood, you know, because what he'll see at the end of that, if the Lord has blessed this, is here's this brand new convert that now is excited about Christ, he's walking with God, his life is changing, and God's used me to help him grow. He's involved in the church. He's responding to the preaching of the Word. He's in fellowship with other believers. This guy's not the same guy that he was 6 months ago or a year ago, however long that process takes. And God used me. Well, I tell you, I get excited about that, you know. And the guys that do it get excited about that. And what God does is, see, takes a load off of your plate as the pastor. You know, if God blesses your evangelism, imagine if it's up to you to meet individually with every new convert to help them become established in their faith. That's a tremendous load. But if you got some people in the congregation that know how to do that and can do that for you, and you have confidence that they know what they're doing, you know, what a blessing. And then you can be focused on, you know, the preaching of the Word and your sermon prep, training people, and you know, so, and occasionally doing this yourself. You know, it's always good to have some times where you take a guy through that. It just keeps you fresh and encouraged and on that kind of, involved in that kind of ministry. All right. Let's see. I think I'm done. Specific training needs. Okay. So I got that final section there. You know, we've got to train people to share the gospel. So part of the training is, I've been focusing on the establishing, but if you're going to train somebody, you need to train them how to do evangelism. As Harry said, teach them a simple gospel illustration. Teach them how to share his testimony. Teach them how to ask good questions. Do a little questions Bible study with them. You know, there's nothing that unlocks a person's heart more than some good questions. You can train people to lead Bible study. I've got an appendix in the back I've told you about where it just kind of shows some basic skills in Bible studying. Teach about how to establish new believers. And then you can develop specific training things for elders and for deacons and for other things as you see needs. You know, you just design these things as necessary. All right, let me stop there. We've got a few minutes left. If there's any questions, if you want to ask any, you can. Yeah, Dick. Yeah, the stuff that's in here, yeah, I think it's all electronic. Bruce, you could probably for Harry, make anything that's in this manual. People want clean copies. Can you do? I know I don't have all that, but somebody probably does.
I'd say send me an email and I'll send you an electronic copy.
Okay.
It's obviously like 40-some pages.
Yeah. He's the guy. Other questions or comments?
Okay, Dave, can you write this one real small so that nobody can see it?
Sure. Do that.
It's Rev, R-E-V, it's a Microsoft Publisher file. So if you want to publish it,
where's Jason? Jason, can you see that? Good. Because you're still in the back, I noticed. Anything else? Okay. I think we're going to break for lunch, right, Bruce?
A few administrative things.
It's all yours.